Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase.
There's a lot to say when buying a new home or car, but only one thing to say that can help you protect them. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. And just like that, a State Farm agent will be there to help you choose the coverage you need, no matter where you are in life. When you need coverage options, your State Farm agent is there to help, on the phone or in person. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Hey, welcome to Nerdist Podcast number 298. I'm sitting in Chloe's apartment while she is vigorously making cupcakes for... Cookies. You're not making cupcakes?
I'm making cookies today, cupcakes tomorrow.
She's making a lot of cookies today and decided for Christmas to make themed cupcakes for every one of her friends. It is like cupcake-ageddon. In the kitchen. There's flour and dough.
That's the best kind of the end of the world.
It is the... If the end of the world is going to come in cupcake form, then I'm just going to lie on my back in the street and wait for cupcake goodness to take me into the netherworld. But I will be performing in Bloomington, Indiana, mid-January. I believe those dates would be... January, oh, I almost have it, the 17th through the 19th. So if you go to Nerdist.com/calendar, you can figure out ways to get tickets to that. I also would like to thank a brand new sponsor to Nerdist Podcast, ThingX. ThingX.com is basically a collaboration between Adult Swim and former writers of The Onion. You can see my pal Joe Randazzo lurking around on there. It's super funny. There's articles and there's videos and there's original series. There's underground comedy talent that you haven't heard of, and then also overground talent that used to be underground talent, but then because they were funny, they got to emerge from the ground and then be public. It's influenced by sci-fi. There's horror. There's how-to videos. There's pretty much everything you can find on the internet. ThingX is sort of a one-stop shop. I want to point out that it is not evil. It is satirizing the World Wide Web, the WWW, as some of the kids call it. And they have new series with Tim Heidecker and Greg Turkington, a.k.a. Neil Hamburger. There's also interviews with Paul Tompkins, a four-year-old boy, a lobster man, and more. Go to ThingX.com, brought to you by Adult Swim and former writers of The Onion, ThingX.com. And now this episode of the Nerds Podcast is my old friend Paul Gilmartin. Paul hosted Dinner and a Movie for the run of Dinner and a Movie. And he was really funny stand-up, really great guy. Had a lot of struggles with mental illness throughout his life. And, you know, within his family, and then struggles of his own. And started a podcast a couple of years ago called The Mental Illness Happy Hour, which is a wonderful podcast. I've been on it. It's just a very open, honest, sometimes funny, sometimes dramatic, but in a good, heartfelt, healthy kind of a way. So I you know, really check out The Mental Illness Happy Hour, and we talk a lot about that stuff in here. There's, you know, very probably kind of similar to the Maria Bamford podcast we just did. Just kind of frank, but not so weighty. I mean, like, a lot of times when people talk about mental health stuff, it's just very serious. And of course, it's a serious thing and deserves to be treated respectfully. But also, you can just talk about it, you know? Like, it doesn't... We're people, and people have shit to deal with, and it's okay just to talk about it. So this was a really great... this is a really great time that we had had Paul on. We recorded this a couple months ago, and I've been hanging on to it. Kind of this idea, like, I'll drop it around the holidays when a lot of the mental stuff percolates to the surface because of the holidays. But loved having Paul on. Check out his podcast. And here it is, Nerdist Podcast number 298 with Paul Gilmartin.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
is the morning zoo here with Paul Kilmartin. We're going to go to traffic in a minute, but then some of our listeners sent in naked pictures of their girlfriends in a little segment we like to call the petting zoo.
That's my favorite part about radio is like those kind of shock jock things that where they just have like, we got a lot of beautiful women in here. It's like, well, good for you. It's like hearing someone have a good time next door to you.
I'm a pussy magnet, but unfortunately the pussies and I are of like polarity. That's a physics joke. Where are all my physics bitches? Paul Kilmartin, thank you for being here on the podcast.
It's my pleasure. I'm excited to be here. I'm glad you had me on.
Now let's talk about feelings.
Let's talk about what?
Feelings. Talk about feelings.
What are you building right now, Paul? What are you building?
Paul Kilmartin, you are a master woodworker. What furniture?
That's an exaggeration.
What furniture are you building in your garage right now?
Well, actually, you saw kind of the prototype of what I want to build more of when Janet, your ex, did that installation.
Why'd you have to bring that up? I'm going to be okay.
That was the Arizona one, the Arizona Spaceman one?
Yes. Yeah, yes. It was Santa Fe Astronaut.
Santa Fe Astronaut. They did that. Yeah, she and Jessica Makinson did their art show, and that was the theme. And it turned, they got a lot of fucking great stuff.
And I bought a lot of
different
that stuff.
Types of stuff. That was what was cool about the installation.
Yeah.
And so Janet asked me to make something for it, and the idea that I came up with was to get a slab of mesquite wood, which is indigenous to the Southwest, and then to inlay the guts of the motherboard of a computer.
Mm-hmm.
And I had an old computer laying around, so I took it apart, and that a lot of people really liked it. And I thought, that might be a fun thing to build for people, is to get slabs of wood and have that contrast. You know, the slab of wood where it's got the free edges and it looks like nature, and have the contrast of maybe people's old computer guts put inlaid into
like an urn almost, like they have their own, like a taxidermy pet.
Yeah.
They can keep by the fireplace. I mean, the piece was great. I will say that Jen and I both agree that that piece did start the demise of our relationship, but I don't want you to feel bad about that.
I should have used a more slender leg.
That's a fucking beautiful line for some reason.
I should have used more slender leg.
Is there any last thoughts before you die?
I should have used more slender leg.
Gacy had that thought, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I wonder if Santa Fe Astronaut, if you could have just put Kevin Spacey in like a Southwestern shirt, and he would have technically qualified to be sold at the auction.
Maybe.
Because
he's played an astronaut.
And his last name is Spacey.
Oh, I gotcha.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't get that.
Oh, yeah, that didn't occur to me.
I find the best jokes have to be explained, you guys. I always find it's best for the comic when he has to do the ... Well, because his last name is...
It's always nice.
Is good.
It's nice if you haven't gotten your daily regimen of awkward silence.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think awkward silence... It's awkward.
Nerdist Podcast, providing awkward silence since 2010.
Yeah, awkward silence is the comic's meditation time. But since we're talking about meditation and mental illness, when did you decide to start your podcast? I think it was, about 2 years ago? Is that about right?
The first episode went up in March or April of 2011. So about a year and a half ago.
It's only been a year and a half?
Uh-huh.
Wow.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
It just feels like the show's been a thing for a while now. The mental illness happy hour.
Well, the maybe because the AV Club started covering it in like its fifth or sixth week, so it got on the radar pretty quick. So maybe that's why.
Yeah.
But the idea for it came up. I've dealt with mental illness, my own mental illness, for probably most of my life, I believe. But I was diagnosed with clinical depression in 2000, and I had no idea. I thought just life was really difficult and everybody was assholes, and if they would just behave the way I needed them to.
I still don't see the error there.
That's not totally wrong.
I still don't see the problem with any of that.
And wanting to kill myself once an hour.
Okay.
Once an hour. All right.
And if you skip an hour, twice the next one.
Just the way a radio station has to ID itself at the top of every hour. And it's 12 o'clock right now, and
I'd rather jump off it.
So I, at the urging of my wife, I went to see a shrink and realized that, yes, I was very clinically depressed, and also I had a drinking and drug problem. And so dealt with the drinking and drugs. And then the shrink was able to help get my mental illness under control. And all of a sudden I realized, oh, this is what normal feels like. This is where there's not crushing anxiety all the time, where you don't scream at people while you're driving, people that aren't even there, just arguments that you'd like to have.
Or remembering old arguments and getting re-pissed about them is one of my personal favorites.
The things that you would have liked to have said.
I run all these like douchebag simulations where I'm like, these are the different ways that could have played out when I got an argument with that guy.
I tend to bum myself out when I'm driving around, and I'll think of like something funny I could have said in a situation from years ago. I'll be like, oh, like,
miss that opportunity.
Man, that would have been great.
I like Chris's like version of the danger room from X-Men. He's just in there.
Oh yeah,
douchebag.
Yeah. Fuck. If somebody could invent a comedy vanity time machine, so you could go back and say the perfect cutting thing.
But then it just changes the entire course of your life.
Yeah,
we have to do a certain amount of suffering in order to figure out what's funny about the world.
We do. I know you're kidding, but you know I'm serious.
Oh, okay. I do believe that. We do, because, you know, if you kind of need a little bit of that, okay, fuck everything, before you want to start making fun of it and deconstructing and figuring it out. Like, if you're just, you know, people who are just super upbeat and happy all the time, with the exception of Will Ferrell, don't really think to go do comedy. I don't think, because they just sort of feel like, oh, everything's all sorted out. Like, you know, with comedy, we're really dealing with stuff and we have to express things, and there's a real commentary that's involved.
Yeah, and there's a reason why the captain of the football team is boring when he's 40 years old.
Yeah. Well, they're boring by the time they're like 25.
Yeah. I thought they were boring in high school.
They're boring in high school, too.
Yeah.
They're boring.
But
they're boring holes in all the cheerleaders, to borrow a term from Paul's master woodsman. Woodsman? You're a woodworker.
Pedophile, right? The woodsman. Isn't that the movie with Kevin Bacon?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Or yes,
the woodsman? Yeah. That was a good movie.
I liked it.
Yeah.
I didn't see it.
To take on such an unsympathetic character.
Yeah, but like you do feel bad for
him. You do.
Which is like the weirdest part about the movie, is that like you're just like, oh, poor pedophile? Wait a minute.
Well, there are some directors who are really good at, like Todd Solondz does a bunch of that, where he tries to make you empathize with the worst people in the world.
Yeah. And happiness.
Yeah. Like, and it kind of fucks with your idea of what a protagonist should be, and I think in that way it's kind of an interesting art experiment that way.
I think the same thing with a lot of the Jody Hill stuff, where it's like, you know, Eastbound and Down, it's kind of daring you to root for Kenny Powers, who you shouldn't be rooting for. Right. You know, you're like, and same thing with I think Breaking Bad right now, where it's like this whole time you're like, come on, Walter, you can, and then like finally now you're just like, oh, fuck you.
Yeah.
But he's the lead, so who do you root for?
Well, but we're at a time where a lot of lead characters are despicable characters. Like almost every show has despicable lead characters.
Yeah.
And maybe that's a commentary about...
I love it.
Yeah.
It was so boring, the era of everybody, all the lead characters had to be the guy next door that rescues kittens. And it's like, okay, we get it. We know you want us.
Now the protagonist is the guy next door who rescues kittens and then fucks him in his basement. But we still love him anyway.
That was a good Dexter episode.
But, I'm interested to talk to you a little bit about, you know, what do you think actually defines clinical depression versus, you know, how we're essentially... There's a lot of over-medicating going on, and people aren't, I mean, you know, when people, as someone said to me not long ago, like, well, do you think people should be on antidepressants? I'm like, well, that is a complex question. Yes, some people need to even out the chemistry of their brain, but a lot of people do not. And Kyle Dunnigan has a really great bit where he's playing a song on the piano, and it's something about Xanax or some sort of a drug, and then he just very offhandedly ends it with, because why should I ever have to feel an uncomfortable emotion? Mm. And I think it really sort of defines where we are. Culturally, right. is a lot of people, if they even feel slight discomfort throughout the day, like, well, I should be on pills. Like, right. no, sometimes, you know, sometimes things are just not awesome.
Yeah, I think that medication should be the last house on the block. I think you should try every other thing to deal with it. I think you should try exercise, nutrition, therapy, spirituality. All, and by that I don't mean organized religions. You know, could be yoga, meditation, volunteer work. You know, stuff to pick up your spirit.
Mm-hmm.
If you're doing all those things and you're still feeling that sense of doom, then I believe it's a chemical thing. And that's what I had to do, because I've gone off them many times after learning to meditate. I was like, okay, maybe, well, that was the missing piece of the puzzle. And I go off my meds and the doom comes back and the tears over nothing.
That's very dangerous, too, to go off your meds.
It is. And my psychiatrist strongly urged me not to, but, you know, I was pre-med, so I got it.
Well, it's like, you know, the whole Brody Stevens breakdown was caused off of him just dropping off of his Lexapro?
I'm not sure what he was on, but yeah, it's really dangerous, and most psychiatrists recommend against it. But nobody likes to be beholden to a big evil corporation that makes pills and doesn't tell you what some of the side effects might be.
Right.
You know, that is the part about taking meds that I hate.
That explains your shoulder cock.
But it's bigger than my actual cock, which is the irony that really makes
now
me.
Now, if we could just find a way to harvest it.
Harvest it. There's a lot of lean fucking. Harry. You lean on people in a subway.
So, you know, my opinion on meds is, yes, a lot of people jump to that to be the first thing, and they don't want to deal with what, you know, that's not going to help you overcome childhood trauma.
No.
Or the fact that you're eating junk food 24 hours a day.
Well, I mean, I don't remember how.
Keep it to 12.
I don't remember how in depth we got in this when I went on your podcast. But you know, the idea that when I quit drinking, there was a flood of emotions. I mean, I was so up and down, and it was almost like, you know, I was almost like this baby vampire who didn't know how to deal with the weird hunger, you know, like,
yeah.
It was this guy, because I had been stifling any emotions for so long by just drinking every day for years that, you know, I was like, oh, this is what, I mean, in a weird sort of way, it was almost like getting hearing back after not having it, or maybe not as severe as that, but still like developing a sense that I wasn't accustomed to having, of like, oh, that's what this is supposed to feel like. Oh, okay. Yeah, no, that feels awful. But as you start to get older and wiser, you start figuring out that, you know, there are ways to deal with that stuff and it doesn't have to be the end of everything.
Yeah. You know, I liken using drugs and alcohol compulsively to like a caveman tool. You know, it worked when that was the only tool you had.
Yeah.
But at a certain point, you need more sophisticated tools to cope with overwhelming emotion. Because to me, you know, addiction, you know, compulsive acting out of any kind, it's all about trying to escape emotions that are overwhelming. And to me, the goal is to try to find the best tools for the certain situations that present themselves. And I've had to develop tools, which I wouldn't have done if I didn't have mental illness and if I wasn't an alcoholic and a drug addict.
Yeah.
So I'm grateful in many ways that I am, because those tools now I can use when I go into a business situation and I'm starting to feel anxiety that, you know, I'm not enough, you know, that I'm looked down on, or, you know, I'm going to get a shitty deal or whatever. So in some ways, it's good. Like you were saying, the kid that isn't popular has to deconstruct things and learn how to look at the world. It can help you in other ways. So I certainly don't regret it. But there's times, like when my depression comes back, that it's just – and I don't want to get out of bed. And it's just – looking at a dish in the sink, I just think, I can't. I can't even wash that. It's just – it's crippling almost. That's when it's like, okay, I'm really not happy to have this.
Oh, you hit your microphone button there. Your hands on your, there you go.
My bad.
That's all right.
That's when it's, I don't see any good in it, but those times don't last that long.
Well, as long as you know that, then somewhere in the back of your... I mean, the tricky thing about anxiety is that no matter how many times you have it, it still can trick you into saying, no, no, I know those other times were just some axons misfiring, but this is the... This is really the time where it's...
Like a breakup, where you're just like, I know I was really sad about that last one, but this one...
This is the real one. You know, I had a doctor... I've never actually been on... Well, you know, actually, when I was in my 20s, a doctor gave me Wellbutrin to quit smoking, which actually worked, but then I started again, but then I quit again.
Wellbutrin?
Neither. No, I took it for, I didn't realize at the time what it was, and then when I found out that what it was, I thought it was just a quit smoking pill. I'm like, no, that's just a side effect. It's actually a, I was like, oh, fuck, and then I stopped taking it.
They put me on that when I was 17.
What was it for?
Wellbutrin.
It's an antidepressant, but it
works on your dopamine. It's one of the drugs that I take, and it helps with if you're lacking vigor.
What about Vim?
Vim, no, it's actually an anti-Vim.
Okay. Moxie?
Yeah, Moxie.
It pretty much evens out your pep levels.
Take everything with Moxie.
But to get back to your question a while back, which was what led to me coming up with the idea for the podcast, it was exactly that. It was the last time I had gone off my meds, or actually I think it was two times ago, the darkness came back. And having experienced the darkness and then it going away and feeling what normal is like, because psych meds don't make you euphoric. They just make you not want to kill yourself when you're working. Not, you know, they allow you to get out of bed. So the darkness came back and I realized, oh my God, I forgot how real it is when it presents itself.
Right.
There are millions of people out there that don't know that. I should do a podcast where I paint the picture for people that are experiencing it so they know they're not alone. They know that you can overcome it, and I can describe what it's like to get help, all that other stuff, and I can have people come on and they can talk about their experiences with
it. You thought about touring with any of this? Like in the sense where that it's sort of like a seminar, but really it's sort of a comedy, but there's a comedy element to it. I mean, just
I think it's actually my dream is to do it. I thought you were being facetious, like doing a comedy.
No. I mean, if you because now you have an audience, and people would come out and see you. And so if you could just go to places and sort of give the, hey, you know, here's what depression is. If you have it, here's how you can start to deal with it. But at the same time, it's you, so it's going to be funny. And it really is kind of a, I think it's just a different approach to what that seminar would normally look like.
Well, that was the other reason when I came up with the idea for the podcast was, I realized that there were only two camps of ways for dealing with mental illness, depression, self-help. There was the Dr. Phil talking down to you, and there was the precious new agey, release your buttocks into Mother Earth, you know, kind of.
Sounds great.
And I thought, nobody's talking about this in the way my friends and I talk about shit. And so I thought it would fill that void, and it has. People like hearing somebody talk about it in a way that isn't precious or condescending.
Yeah, I mean, I did that a little bit in the book talking about anxiety, but in my book, because I just felt like so much talk about that stuff is that people walk on eggshell and they're like, hey, you know what? I feel like it gives us a little more power over it to be like, hey, it's fucking, you know, like, let's just fucking figure it out. You know, it sucks, but we experience it, and fuck it, we'll just figure it out.
There is a certain joy to swapping jokes about being molested with somebody on the podcast. You know, I was molested by a neighbor, and there's something very freeing because you're not a victim anymore. If you can laugh about it with somebody else, obviously you need to process it before that.
Of course.
But there
started crying right in the middle of a bit. It was weird.
There are jokes that you can crack when you have lived through, you know, years of feeling suicidal and having been molested and being an alcoholic and a drug addict and your father having tried to kill himself, you know, all that darkness, but it's not who I am today. And it's freeing to be able to look back at it and to be able to talk with somebody else, and they know that you've lived through it, so you can joke about things that somebody who hasn't lived it never ever
well
could.
Because you've overcome it, and you it gives you kind of a you're sort of wielding power over it and saying, like, I can deride you because you didn't kill me.
Yeah.
And, which is I think is sort of a that is a badge that you have earned, you know?
Thanks. I appreciate that. Some days I don't feel worthy of that because I think that there's too much responsibility that comes with it. My big fear doing the podcast is that people are going to think that I think I'm an expert. And I say the intro to every show is, this isn't the doctor's office. It's not meant as a substitute for professional mental counseling. It's not their doctor's office. It's more like a waiting room that hopefully doesn't suck. And my big message is, get help. I am not your help. While I may have stuff to share occasionally that is helpful, the
right.
gist of it is to let people know this is a thing, it's real, you're not alone.
You got help, so tell other people I have
yes,
to get help.
Yes, a pompous ass like me can learn to get help. Anybody.
You know, right after I quit drinking, right around the time that I quit drinking, I was experiencing horrible, horrible, horrible anxiety, and then you find, like, oh, you're suppressing anxiety by numbing yourself with alcohol, but the chemical effect that has long-term on your body is that it actually creates more anxiety, which makes you drink more. Like, it really, yes. like, when you go into withdrawal and then you have more anxiety, so you just, and then you start drinking all the time, and, you know, you just try to stay in that numb state so you don't have to feel anything.
Yeah.
But right around that time, a doctor gave me, I was never put on antidepressants for any kind of mental anything other than the quitting smoking thing, you know, a long time ago. But he put me on, it was a really interesting approach. He put me on blood pressure medication.
Really?
So that my blood pressure would be low so that I wouldn't go into anxiety mode. And I'm not recommending that people go do this. I'm just telling you that for me, it actually kind of worked for a little while until one time with a lady, I couldn't make it happen.
You need the pressure in the right spot.
Because I was taking blood pressure medication, and I was like, daddy's got to have his boners, no more pills.
I've used that excuse too, Chris.
What?
I've used that same excuse.
Yeah, so all I'm saying is because I took that pill a long time ago is why I don't get boners now. No, guys, I get plenty of boners now, okay? I just want to make that clear.
But you were able to break the news to her in a very relaxed manner.
Here's the situation.
My parents went away for a week's vacation. Yeah. They took the keys to the brand new Porsche my boner pills.
What of, though, the idea that how do you decipher between, because I have, you know, I'm not on any medication. I drink regularly. But there are times where I feel good. There are times where I just, like, I'm not feeling too great. And what's the...
That's life.
That's just life,
that's
right?
Yeah. Yeah. People thinking that if you go on meds, you're not going to experience sadness or disappointment. No, you still experience those things, but they don't keep you in the house for a week.
Yeah.
You know, they don't have you in tears, unable to function.
Also, every little thing shouldn't feel like, well, this is the worst thing that's ever happened, and now everything's fucked up forever.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I had a girlfriend, we were living together, and she went on Lexapro as like anti-anxiety because she was just working all the time. Getting
What's
really
her
up.
Name?
it was weird because, like, you know, we had a bunch of problems, and it was like always kind of tense and argumentative, and she went on Lexapro, and it was like having the best version of that girlfriend. And it was weird because I was like, I didn't want to say anything, I didn't want to jinx it. I was like, you know, it was like we started like having sex again. We like were having fun. She was like smiling a lot more, and I was like, oh, I fucking love science. Like, this is great.
That's a perfect way of putting it, Jonah, because that's what one of my shrinks said to me. Is he said, it doesn't change who you are. It allows the real you to come forward because it's not masked by a chemical imbalance.
Well, it just, you know, because you're fucking with brain chemistry, you just have to make sure that you have a professional that you trust. Because if you start taking pills, if you get a doctor who's just like, take a bunch of these pills, you start getting cocktails of pills. Well, this will bring you up here, but then this will even, you know, that's when you start getting into really dangerous territory.
Like Ozzy Osbourne.
If you don't know what you're doing.
Season of the Ozzy.
Well,
and drinking with them.
And drinking with them, yeah, because
not a good idea.
Yeah, but a buddy of mine, I forget what he's taken, but like he says, like when he's on the drugs, that he just doesn't feel like drinking, and like it's like he'll have a beer and be like, nah, I'm all right, which is weird because it's curbed that. Even though it's making him feel better. Yeah.
Which makes sense because it curbs the anxiety. And for problem drinkers, that's the reason why we drink, is because we can't relax like a normal person can. We can't shut that spinning brain off.
And I know how Chris was drinking because I met you when you were still drinking. And
yeah.
Yeah. And like, but like, what was the case in your drinking that you thought it was a problem?
That's a good question because I didn't think I was an alcoholic, even though almost every male in my genetic tree is an alcoholic. I didn't drink during the day. I didn't drink when I golfed. I mean, I never had a DUI. So I thought, but I did drink every night, and I would drink anywhere from 2 or 3 beers to 12, depending on where I was.
It's funny, after you quit and then you get a little distance from it, you look back and you start going, oh, that's why I did. That's why I had that all the time. Or, oh no, you shouldn't do that every, like, I got so much clarity that I just didn't have, because the gift and the detriment to humanity is that we are violently adaptable, which is, you know, why we have survived, to our level of the food chain, is that we're incredibly adaptable. And so you can adapt to any environment pretty much. And when you're sort of in that, for me anyway, that sort of, you know, like that hardcore drinking environment, it, for most of the time, it didn't seem that weird to me. And it just sort of felt like, this is fine. And then, and I couldn't imagine how I wouldn't be able to, you know, like get on a plane and not have beers or whatever. But then when you quit and you go, no, that was just a fucked up pattern that I had, and I can adapt to this other way. But it's, you know, people who are on crazy cocktails of pills and drinking, and It's just fucking nuts.
Yeah, it is shocking sometimes to look back and see what your life was like and how that became your normal, and how kind of small and sad you begin to accept things are. Because if you're afraid to ask for help, and that's the thing I really stress on the show, is ask for help. It's the smartest thing you can ever do. People think, oh, if I ask for help, that makes me look weak. You know, weakness is running away from a problem. Strength is staring that problem in the face and saying, I need reinforcements. That to me is the ultimate strength, is facing that problem.
Yeah.
But most people can't get over that societal kind of myth that you're weak if you ask for help. But saying I need help, I can't do this on my own, it absolutely saved my life. And that's the thing I try to urge people to do. One of the things on the podcast I have is there's about a half dozen surveys that people can take on the website, because I love learning about the listeners and hearing what it is that they're going through, and especially their shame and their secrets. And one of the surveys I have is called the Shame and Secret Survey, and people share their deepest, darkest thoughts, fantasies, secrets, and it is absolutely fascinating. And it's really educated me on the shit that people bury and the sick coping mechanisms that they have. I've found at least a half a dozen women who were asleep, a guy started having sex with them, and they were so afraid of confronting the guy, they pretended that they were asleep and allowed themselves.
You mean like a guy that they knew, or a guy who literally just raped them in their sleep?
Like somebody at a party.
Oh my God.
A cousin. And then they carry this shame around that they couldn't stick up for themselves. That's how deep our inability of, if we had some type of trauma in childhood, or, you know, we're raised in a really dysfunctional environment, that's how deep our inability to stand up for ourselves can be. And that's one of the things that I talk about a lot on the podcast, is how to have compassion for yourself, how to learn to stick up for yourself. Because a lot of us were raised by super needy, inappropriate parents that didn't have boundaries. And so we learn that our needs aren't important and we have to serve their needs. So we grow up not even knowing what our needs are. All we know is, if I can make everybody in the room feel okay, then I'll be okay.
Well, it's not only that, but, you know, like, I was raised, I went to Catholic school, which is just like,
its own.
I mean, there you know, there are some good. There were a lot of really good parts to it, obviously. But then there's the whole like, you should feel bad about everything. And we were, I mean, like the whole idea of like, we were born to sin. We were born out of sin, you know. And it's like, come on, fucking let's. And there, and we carry that, you know, through the rest of our lives. And there's such an economy of guilt with particularly Catholics and also Jews that I know. It's like just that whole idea of like, you should feel bad about everything. Like, how many conversations have you gotten into with people where you're like, I feel bad that I made you feel bad, and now I feel bad about that, and now you feel bad, and now I feel bad that you're feeling, but then you feel worse because I feel bad. Like, there's so much, it's just, there's so much wasted energy on useless, like, guilt that creates anxiety. Well,
and there's a funny thing about that, too, where it's, you know, you could feel bad, but just feel bad. Don't feel bad upon feeling bad. Like, that's, like, something I try to, like, you know, me and my girlfriend talk about a lot. Where it's like, oh, I did this. I'm so angry at myself. And then I feel bad because I'm getting angry at myself. And mm-hmm. I was like, well, wait, those are two different things. Feel just the one. Feel bad that you messed up.
There are so many layers of guilt.
And my belief on that is that's actually narcissism and self-obsession disguised as I'm disciplining myself. You know, people that beat themselves up all the time, it's a way of allowing yourself to continue obsessing about yourself. It's really quite selfish.
That's an interesting point of view that I'd never considered before, but I think I might have to agree with you.
Yeah, that makes a lot of
sense.
You're
very selfish, Chris.
Were you talking to me?
Now, don't beat yourself up if you realize that about yourself. That's the other thing I stress on the podcast is to get outside of yourself. Volunteer work, support groups, you know, hobbies, things where you interact with other people and you can stop sitting in your lazy boy trying to predict what the world is going to look like, how it's going to unfold, because that is one of the hallmarks of mental illness is just sitting there and obsessing about the future, or at least compulsive negative thinking.
Okay, now is this a hallmark? All I obsessed about was lazy boy, and now I really want a lazy boy. I should get a lazy boy, right?
Yeah, I think it's time for you to get a lazy boy.
No, I think you should keep on listening to what everybody's saying.
I mean, again, I
don't understand.
I think I may have said this on the podcast before, but I think a good rule of thumb is, you know, learn from the past, plan for the future, but live in the present.
Absolutely.
You know,
a lot of words.
It is a lot of words, but you know, your brain can only focus on one thing at a time. It is impossible, even though we can multitask to a degree, it is impossible to focus on more than one thing at a time. So if, like you said, get outside yourself, go volunteer, you're going to be focused on that. And that will take you out of, like, stand-up was always a cure for anxiety for me because I couldn't focus on my anxiety when I was on stage. Because I was just too it is literally impossible to focus on two things at once. So if you can get outside that for even a minute, it just sort of, you can distract your brain in other directions. And I think that's what a lot of us do who suffer from any form of anxiety or depression is just we're constantly trying to distract ourselves from the chatter.
Yeah, that's the bliss of losing yourself in a hobby. And, you know, the nerd brain, as you describe it, needs that thing to obsess on. I mean, there's a reason why I've been obsessive about every single hobby I've ever had. You know, the first time I bought a camera, within a year and a half, I had taken so many pictures, the picture counter rolled over. you know, the first time I started buying domain names, within 4 days, I had 500 domain names. Jeez. And this was when they were $70 a pop. I went into debt.
What's your dumbest domain name that you own?
Old People Fucking. Now get this. .net. I didn't think even .com was enough. That's how sick my brain was.
I thought you were
going to
say that .com wasn't available.
What was the idea behind that? It's like, I'm going to get all these and then I'm going to fucking sell them when someone comes knocking.
Yeah.
Have you sold any of those?
Two.
Two of them. Which ones?
The rest of them I let go. I sold Blue Comedy or X-Rated Comedy. I can't remember what the name of it was. There was two or three that I sold, but most of them were just flaming balls of shit.
Yeah,
and that was like almost kind of like gambling. You were just was a gamble.
Absolutely. Yeah. But when you are in your mental illness, you think you're so anxious, you think this is my savior. I thought this is the Wild West, this is the land rush, and in many ways it was, but not for oldpeoplefucking.net.
Well, now hang on. Yeah, mine.
I should have brought
the list in. Which is a surprise that never.
Mine were. Mine were
oldpeoplefucking.tv.
Tallulah.
Mine were. Dude, my nipples are huge.com. And papal nip slips, I thought would be really funny. Just like a Tumblr, like just a page of like, of just fake Pope, like Pope nip slips throughout the ages.
My friend, as a joke, it's got a sandpaper condom. and he, like in his head, he was like, it was going to be a weird side. Then he just like, now it's just my side.
No,
it's just, yeah, this is what I tell people to go to.
Yeah. You brought some paperwork here. Is this?
Oh, these are just some of the surveys. I thought if you guys were interested in seeing some of the things that people like here, I want to read this one. This, one of the things you can check on, have you ever been the victim of sexual abuse? Is some stuff happened, but I don't know if it counts as sexual abuse. This is the most fascinating thing on the survey to me because you cannot believe what some people aren't sure is abusive or not.
Dude, when I used to guest host Loveline and people would call in, there would always be some horrible thing that they didn't, that just didn't occur to them was the, or like a girl would go, like, so a girl would call in and go, or like say a dude would call in and go, you know, I don't know what it is, but I really like to be punched in the face during sex. You know, like, what is that about? And Drew would go, well, you know, what happened to you when you're younger? Nothing. So really nothing happened. And then Drew would kind of lean away from the mic and he'd go sexual abuse and then go back to the, like, to just to me. And he'd go back to Mike and go, what happened to you when you're younger? And he'd go, you know, I can't really think of anything. Well, this one time an uncle put three fingers in my butt, you know, when I was like four. Do you think that could be like, they would literally yeah, like, do you think that could be it?
During the Ali Frazier fight. Yeah.
So,
my own personal rumble in the jungle.
Yeah. So anytime I see jungles or getting hit in the face, I can't go to the Philippines without. But yeah. But it's just the idea that horrible things happen, but people just, it just becomes so much a part of their mental routine that they don't stop to go, oh, actually, that was a really fucked up thing that probably, you know, yielded all of these really horrible emotional results.
Well, you know, I just went through one of those about 3 months ago. I finally was able to see my relationship with my mom for what it was, because as a kid, I could never allow myself to say, hey, my primary caregiver is abusive. I couldn't go there. So I would blame myself on the things that she would do, the things that she would say, you know, the boundaries that were creepy that she would violate, because I couldn't, a little kid can't go there. So it's too terrifying.
Well, it doesn't even make sense. When you're a little kid, you don't have the experience and wisdom to know. You just think, oh, this is how it works.
Yeah.
This is how, you know, this is what every kid, you know, goes through, and they just don't know. So what is an example of some of the stuff?
This is from a woman is in her 30s. She checked the box. Some stuff happened. Don't know if it counts as sexual abuse. And then she explains, my stepdad, who was never good when it starts up with stepdad, not sure. My stepdad, who raised me and I love very much, used to watch me in the shower from the ages of 13 to 17. I'd often see the door open when I was in the shower, but could never catch who it was because by the time I was done, whoever was at the door would be gone. We moved when I turned 17 in a house that had a bathroom in my bedroom, so the peeping stopped until one day I saw a shadow at the bottom of my bedroom door. I opened my door to find my stepdad on his stomach, peeping under the door. When I asked what he was doing, he said he was checking to see if I was awake. She doesn't consider that abusive.
It is definitely violating.
Yeah, I mean, that,
if someone is looking at your exposed body in a way that they are being sneaky about it, and yeah, you don't know what's happening.
Devil's advocate, how else are you gonna know if she's awake?
Okay, right. You know, Matt brings up a really not valid point at all. And so did you write back? Did you talk about it on the show?
One of the things that I do is I don't get people's email addresses,
sure,
or even the IP address,
sure,
of,
sure,
their,
sure,
computer, because I've had people admit to crimes. I want them to feel completely assured that they can unload the deepest, darkest stuff.
So you just get their social security number and the last two addresses.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, with, I have the same, I sort of had the same approach as you with like, I'm not an expert. I'm a guy who went through a bunch of shit, but I do feel like, you know, if you have the platform and you can get to enough people and just at least get them to start asking the right questions, then it's sort of up to them. You know, like you have the ability to be a catalyst, really.
Absolutely.
So you may not necessarily be an expert, but you're really, you know, you're an expert catalyst in a sort of way.
And that's what I hope to be. And I get a lot of emails from people who thank me for letting them know that they shouldn't be ashamed to go see a psychiatrist, to go see a therapist, to go to a support group, or to just open up. I had a woman who filled out a shame and secret survey a couple of weeks ago, and I read her survey, and she was so touched that I had read her survey. She emailed me, and then she opened up more about stuff, and I encouraged her to go to therapy and to, you know, find a safe friend to talk to. And she did. And she wrote me back and she said that she has a new lease on life, that her soul feels lighter because she shared stuff with this other safe friend. And then that person shared stuff. And she's like, and now we have this real relationship and we're not talking about the weather. And that to me is what the podcast was meant to do.
And when I say to people, you know, if someone's having a rough time or whatever, and I go, you know, maybe you should talk to someone. And like, even if it's a therapist, and they go, well, I don't need some psychiatrist to tell. Like there's this kind of old idea about like what that means. And I always say, listen, you know, you have to think of it like exercise. You know, even if you do nothing more than 1 hour a week, you go in to talk to someone and you can be as selfish with your time as possible and just get stuff out to a person who is not only a professional, but will not judge you. That is really important because it's sort of like you have to release the steams. Like you have to turn the valves regularly because that shit builds up. And we are beings who need to communicate and we need to express things, but we're also horrified of being judged and we feel guilt. So you need to be within a relationship dynamic where you are safe and that will not happen. And even just that alone, even if nothing crazy is going on in your life, it is very helpful, I think, to mental health to just have that kind of relationship because you can't always dump that shit off on your significant other. You know, Jan, I don't think this is talking too much out of, I think this is too revelatory, but you know, there was a period in my relationship with Janet where we kind of had that toward each other. It was just like, out in the world, we were like, oh, everything's great. Then we come home and we just dump all our problems on each other. And that's not healthy for a relationship.
Yeah, no. And people think that if you go to a therapist, you're going to a therapist because that person is smarter than you. And so a lot of people never go to therapy because they're like, no, I know any therapist I'm going to go to is not as smart as me. But it's not about intelligence. It's about having a different perspective. And therapy is almost like, you need to look at the back of your head. You can never look at the back of your head. You need somebody else to describe the back of your head to you. And that's what therapy is. It's a process, also kind of like the weightlifting that you were talking about. It stuff needs to come out.
That's exactly. You know, like David Allen, who is a big productivity guru, who I based a lot of stuff on when I wrote in the book, his whole thing about and this spills over into productivity is that you can't start to become productive about your life until you see everything laid out in front of you. Like you have to, every time you have an open loop in your head or a task, you have to get it down on paper so that you can see it, so you can figure out what to do with it. And most people just sort of feel like, no, it's fine, I'm dealing with something. Like no, you got to get it out, fucking write it down, tell it to someone, make a, you know, like, you know, use your iChat camera and just get it out. Like just say, you just have to literally just get it out in the open because we are expressive beings, and that is how we have to exist.
Yeah, writing is so therapeutic, and it gives you a perspective. It allows you to see a little bit of the back of your head, getting it down on
third
on
person
paper.
Third person perspective.
Yeah,
on yourself.
Absolutely.
What do you think is the worst shame and secrets that you've ever seen? Like where you kind of felt like, I think I need to fucking track this person down and really get them help.
Well, I had one guy who actually had molested both of his daughters, but he he did time for it, and he's now in a support group to help, you know, deal with it. And he has total remorse, and he knows that his obligation now is to deal with his sex addiction and and to deal with that. I had one person admit to having killed somebody when he was 13, but he said it was a child molester and he would do it again. Because he
think that's fair.
There's so many. 2,300 people have taken the Shame and Secret survey so far, and you can go and see everybody's results. That's the one thing I wanted.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah, I wanted everybody. So when you, if you go to the website,
which is
the podcast is Mental Illness Happy Hour, and the website is mentalpod.com, and you'll see a little thing there that says survey and results, and you can either take the survey or you can look at the results. So you can scroll through all of the surveys, see how everybody responded to it. You can it's fascinating. I'm on there every day learning about people, and there's also upbeat surveys. There's like ones where people list their happiest moments. There's funny ones like vacation arguments, because I've noticed like the worst arguments I've ever had in my relationship have been on vacation.
Always.
And there's something beautifully sick about like yelling while you've got a snorkel in your mouth, you know, or giving somebody the silent treatment while you're wearing ski goggles. You know,
I have a lot of theories about why people argue on vacations. Number one, I think it's slightly off-putting to be out of your regular environment for any length of time. And you feel a little out of control, and so you might be a little more like, a little more prickly. And also, late at night is a bad time to have any kind of serious discussion about anything, because you're just not all there. But particularly on vacation, I think when we're in our daily routine, our defenses are up, because like I know my routine and my defenses are up, and I can protect myself. Then you start to relax a little bit, defenses come down. Shit starts coming out that you've been walling up for a long time.
And I think you both bring expectations to how the vacation's going to go. And every moment of a vacation is a compromise. Arguments. So it's like your two things have to.
What do you mean you didn't pack that? Why didn't you pack the thing? You were supposed to pack the thing.
My wife and I were skiing one time in Mammoth, and she thought I was skiing too fast and ignoring her. And I thought she was purposely skiing too slow. And so we got in this huge argument, and we got on the chairlift, and she didn't sit quite right on the chairlift. So she's starting to fall off, and the chairlift's going higher and higher. And there's that point, and I've got her like in the movie where, you know, she's gripping my forearm, I'm gripping her forearm, and we're about, I don't know, 5 or 6 feet off the ground. And I have to decide, am I going to try to pull her up and risk, if it doesn't work, we're going to then be at 12 feet and she's going to get hurt. Or do I let her go now, you know, and just get it over with?
So you shot her.
And so I just relished the moment and just looked at her with just a dead, dead face and said, I got to cut you loose. I just dropped her, and her face was... I can't even describe it, but it was like, fuck you. Yes, I understand. And
fuck,
I'll see
thank
you in about 15 minutes.
I think it's
and
fuck
we're going to talk about
fuck
this.
Thank you.
Oh, my God.
But fortunately,
there's that gap, too, because you just keep going up and you're just waiting there, like, all right.
What you going to say? Yeah. But we laugh about it to this day.
Oh, my God. That's amazing.
Yeah,
oh, my God.
But that made me think that I bet other people have vacation arguments.
Oh, my God, of course.
So, you know, if anybody wants to go share their deepest, darkest
stuff. There's also the frustration of, like, this is supposed to be the happiest time of the year.
Yeah. That's why you see families getting on each other's nerves at Disneyland. Just like, come on! Right. I brought you here. I paid money for you to have fun. Now fucking have fun!
I don't know how you guys feel around Christmas, but... I feel like a Martian around Christmas because everybody's so happy. And I'm just always reminded of Christmas at my house, which was not happy. It felt like obligation. It just felt, I don't know. I don't know how to describe it. But every time Christmas rolls around, I feel like, why can't I feel the way other people feel.
I have it kind of both ways. Like, my immediate family, we had a blast at Christmas. It was really casual for us. It was just kind of like presents and goofing off. But then we would have to go to my dad's, you know, family's, like, events, and it was just like, okay. Like, it was, like, real. Everyone was angry. Everything was very, like, here is your present. Like, right. Just everything, but nothing, no joy.
Yeah.
You know, everyone
fucking
was just,
season telling me how to feel.
It's like everybody was just waiting to leave. And, like, it was like, we were like, oh, it's family. We have to do this. And my parents were just like, ah, don't worry. We'll go home and we'll watch Christmas Story. And we'll just, like, you know, we'll make some hot chocolate, you know. So
it's so nice that you had the other thing to go back to.
Yeah. It was very nice. It was like, you know, my family was sometimes to a fault, like, very casual.
You know, it's interesting because my mother and I are fundamentally different in with the fact that she was raised with a very large family. I mean, she only had one brother, but my grandfather had 10 brothers and sisters. And so holidays were always these huge family to-dos. And every Sunday after they were Italian Catholic, they'd all go to mass. And then my great grandparents and my great aunts would make these, you know, homemade Italian Sunday afternoon meals. And I'm an only child. And so I am comfortable in isolation, and I'm not a big family person just because I was allowed to be selfish when I was growing up because I didn't have, you know, I didn't really grow up near that. A little bit, but not much. And my poor mom is a very big family person, and I'm just I'm fine just alone. So it is a very interesting dynamic that we have, even with just my mom, because of the way that we were both raised so differently.
Yeah, there is a dynamic. I've always loved being around big families because it was the opposite of what it was like in my family. I always joke that my family growing up was like the movie Ordinary People without the belly laughs. for those of you that are too young have seen the movie Ordinary People.
That movie is heart-wrenching, but it is a fucking amazing movie.
We had to watch that in high school. Our theology teacher showed it to
ours
us.
Ours too!
Yeah. And it ended, and we all fucking, for some reason, we're all just a bunch of shitty high school kids, and we all just, like, cracked up and started clapping.
Well, of course.
When it was over, and then he fucking turned off the he's like, in 20 years, I've never had that reaction to this movie. And I was like, well, it's pretty funny. Mary Tyler Moore does
some
funny stuff.
You do root for her to leave at the end, and you do root for Donald Sutherland to, well, now if you haven't seen it, I've just spoiled it. But it is spoiler alert,
it's really
the movie's
not
30 years old.
Netflix instant.
But I do recommend it as a movie because I think as a film, it so beautifully captures that, and as a book, it so beautifully captures that kind of dysfunctional family dynamic. You know, some horrible thing happens, but they have to have this perfect face of a family, and so they mash it all down, and then all that fucking shit magma starts bubbling to the surface, you know, and
the elephant in the room that nobody will talk about.
Yeah,
and it drives the teenager to,
just like what you said about, like, when you're a kid and you don't know that there's supposed to be another way, and that poor Timothy Hutton's character, Connie, literally is not equipped to be expressive because everything's supposed to be neat and perfect and tucked down, and he just doesn't understand. And when Judd Hirsch finally gets him to let it go, it just completely changes his outlook.
Yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful movie. But some people don't, you know, if you weren't raised around people that know how to express their emotions, and nobody teaches you, you don't know how to do that. And that's what my parents were like. They didn't know how to express their emotions. I never saw my parents kiss. I never saw them hold hands. I never saw them express any affection.
Fingering?
I did see my dad finger my mom.
Okay,
once.
Just one time.
But did they fight?
When they were fingering?
Fight fingering?
Yeah. Fight fingering. Yeah. Oh, fightfingering.com. Why did I not get that?
Damn it! Oh, why didn't we catch you when you were in that obsessive phase?
It's really easy. Just go, listen, you.
You point your finger.
A little. But if you don't know how to do that, it makes life really, really difficult. But that's what my relationship with my parents was like. And I just for once wanted to scream, why the fuck are you married? You hate each other. But you don't. You just go smoke weed.
I think I did scream that to my parents because my parents were very emotional and very expressive. But they had wicked fights, never physical in any way, but just like, you know, and it was like at a certain point, I think I was like 10 or 11. I was like, why are you guys together? Mm-hmm. I mean, I said, why are you guys together?
What did you remember what they said?
You know, it was just one of those moments where during a fight, no one is communicating on a rational level.
The sex is fabulous, Christopher.
All right, I was just checking. Thanks, Dad.
We couldn't hear him over the Donkey Kong.
That's right. Video games helped.
I was wondering, a lot of, like, in my head when I'm talking to people, I find a lot of growing up and being like is forgiving your parents for just being people.
Yeah.
And it's like I try to tell some of my friends that when they're just like, my dad is blah, like they kind of still have all those, like, I was like, you got to understand they're you're as old as they were now. And like, you just kind of got to chalk it up to like, it's like, hey, they're just they're just people.
They're not gods.
Yeah, exactly. Just like, you know, forgive them for being fuck ups, forgive them for being dumb, forgive them for being irritating, you know.
We are, because I think we're biologically programmed as children to... That is the ruler of our universe. That is the ruler of my universe, and I need to stick close to them so I can survive.
It's a commandment, too.
And then at a certain point, if you don't kind of start to, not be disrespectful, but realize, like, they're infallible. I mean, like, they're not infallible. They're fallible creatures. That it really, it's a healthy thing. It's a healthy thing to be able to do.
Yeah, and to be able to have compassion. Like, my mom it feels weird to say this so publicly, but she's a sick person. You know, I believe that she believes what she believes. But I have tremendous compassion for her. I had to cut contact with her. And it's been probably 4 months just because I don't feel safe around her. And I left her a message and I said, I don't hate you. I'm not angry with you. I just need a break because I'm exhausted by our relationship. And so I'm probably going to communicate with her again just through letter because it feels safer to me. And I'm sure I'll go back to visiting her, but I needed that space to be able to process stuff and to have some compassion for her
Can I ask you a truly horrible question?
Sure.
And you won't be mad at me?
No.
But it is something that I'm curious about. What if in this moment you're not communicating with her, she dies? How will you feel?
I've thought about that. I would be okay. I would be okay with it because I spent 40 years of my life putting her needs first, mm-hmm. and it almost killed me. It almost killed me. And cutting contact with her was the hardest thing I ever had to do. I felt like a part of my chest was just had a gaping hole in it.
Yeah.
And it hurt so bad, but I got to the other side of that and I was able to feel strength in not being a puppet. Not that she consciously is a puppeteer, but she's not mentally well and she can be really volatile. It's like one moment she's telling me I'm the greatest person on earth in a way that's almost creepy and like overly drinking me in. And then the next moment telling me that this is stupid and denying that something I actually experienced ever happened.
Oh yeah. Well, that's not a stable environment
So to give myself distance from that, to be able to process it feels really good. And I think I had to do that because if I would have been taking her phone calls while I was processing that stuff, I would have been so phony talking to her because I wouldn't have been able to say anything other than I'm really fucked up over what happened to me as a kid.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to do that. She's 84 years old. She's not going to change.
No, probably not at this point.
I don't want her to have to deal with that because if she were 60, I think that might be different. But, you know, I talked to my therapist about it. There's no way I could have gone through this thing alone. And I just didn't have the perspective. So, you know, I talked to people in the support group. I talked to my therapist. I talked to my wife. You know, when this whole thing came up and I was finally able to see what my mom was really like, I'd always had this fantasy when I was in like first grade of going to an older girl on the playground and wrapping my arms around her and just being able to sob. And I didn't know why. And I've really had it my whole life. And when I got into therapy, I realized, oh, you know, I wasn't mothered properly, but I didn't know what it was that kid wanted to say. And when this stuff finally came up and I finally took that option off the table of your mom couldn't possibly have not loved you. Once I took that option off the table, this emotion came up and I went to my wife and I asked her for a hug and I wrapped my arms around her and the words came out. I said, she tricked me and she used me. I didn't deserve it. I was a good boy. And I sobbed the deepest tears I've ever, ever sobbed. And my wife said, I've been waiting 20 years for you to say that.
Holy shit.
So she felt it the whole time, but she can't say anything to you about
that.
The
first hour she saw my mom, she knew that that's what was going on. And she has always told me, you have not fully dealt with your stuff with your mom. You are underestimating how much damage she has caused.
Well, because again, going back to the whole sort of like we're adaptable thing, we just accept... We will just accept horrible circumstances. It's like, no, this is just how it is. Whatever, it's not a big deal. This is just how it is. Meanwhile, all of the lower levels of your brain, which you don't have, you know, direct access to all the time, are just sort of figuring out, like, just like a Rubik's Cube, like, how the fuck do I solve this? You know, like, and then before you know it, it just starts bubbling up in other weird areas.
It's gonna come out. So you might as well have it come out in a way that's healthy, that causes the least amount of damage. And that's what therapy does for me. I was able to come up and out, as opposed to me, you know, shooting somebody on the freeway because they cut me off. Because that's the other way it used to come out, is I would get in fights. You know, I play hockey, and the things that I used to do when I would get mad playing hockey, I got in a fight one time with a guy, and wasn't able to get a good punch in. And so the referees pulled me off him, and I was so angry that I tried to spit at the guy, and my spit hit the referee in the face.
So you don't get to stay in the game after that, then?
I got banned for like 6 games, and you know, my friends all made fun of me. But that's where my anger goes if I don't process it in a way that's healthy.
So the long and short of it is, you know, just because we're about at our hour here is, I sound like a therapist. We're about at our hour, Paul. Don't try to deal with shit on your own. Find someone that you can talk to who you know is safe and won't judge you and will let you kind of deal. Like, you know, even if that other person, even if that therapist is the kind of therapist that won't necessarily interfere, but just get you to stir up your own thoughts and be a sounding board. Sometimes just being able to say stuff out loud will make you go, when you hear it hit you back in the ears and you're like, oh, wait a minute. You know, like you kind of have those moments. So it's really, really, really important to do that. And, you know, Mental Illness Happy Hour is your podcast, mentalpod.com.
Yep.
And then, you know, the surveys, I think, is a really fun idea. Mm. Obviously not everything that comes out of it is fun, but it's an interesting way to at least maybe help people start to make some of those first steps or asking some of those questions. But ultimately, you know,
and there's a forum too on the website.
Oh, okay, great.
And that's a great way to initially get stuff up.
A nice support group.
Get a sounding board with other people.
But I think the important thing, and I think the thing that you're a testament to is, you know, pretty much no matter what you're going through, that ultimately, you know, you can be okay. I think that's the important message for people to take away is no matter how dark or no matter how deep it feels, like you're just in a, where it's like the ring where you're in a well and you just see like a tiny ring of light, you know, like you can get out of it. Somebody else has lived it. Yeah. Yeah. And that's why support groups, you know, it was very comforting to me, you know, particularly with anxiety or like drinking or whatever, like, oh, because we all want to be unique, but there's something really cool about in those moments of feeling like I am not unique at all, which means that this is territory that has been dealt with before, which means there are answers.
Yes.
And there's a community and there are people that will understand. And I'm not just this fucking island of misery.
Right.
You know, I'm actually attached to a landmass.
I know I'm in my sickness when I think I'm better than people or worse than people. And I know that I'm in a good place when I feel, when I'm content being one of many.
Yeah.
And that's, those are the best moments.
Is there, just before we never even talked about Dinner and a Movie, which was a phenomenal show, which is, has like, was on television for like 18 years.
Yeah, 16 years from 95 to 2011.
But so we'll have to have you back on and then we'll talk about Dinner and a Movie. Because Dinner and a Movie was a great
comedy next time.
Yeah. thank you so much for having me.
Dinner and a Movie was such a great show, and Claude was great. And I know Janet loved being there for like the last 6 years that she was on the show. Yeah. And you guys did such a wonderful job. And I know that, Even as long as the show is on, I know people were really bummed to see the show go away because you guys did such a great job.
How else would I know how to make meatballs when I watch Goodfellas?
Seriously. What were they called? Do you remember what were they called? Did they have a name?
I don't think we showed Goodfellas.
Oh, you didn't?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
It was just a
joke. You were going to say, how am I going to know how to make meatballs? Because when you guys showed meatballs.
These are the meatballs from Meatballs.
That's too on the nose for Dinner and a Movie.
Oh, sorry.
Thank you.
This is how I learned how to make pizza from Hot Dog the Movie.
All right. Yeah.
Go back and get your shine box of fucking hot dogs. Go get your fucking shine box. But is there just sort of one thing? Is there sort of one mantra that you know, just to kind of help people as we wrap up this podcast? Is there some sort of one mantra? You know, at the end of our episode, we always say, enjoy your burrito, which basically just means, as we've explained many times, don't live in the past or the future. Just enjoy the present while it's happening, because that's what you have. But I think rather than saying enjoy your burrito today, is there one thing that you could sort of like send people off with that they could kind of practice to themselves?
Keep seeking. The people that are most successful emotionally in life are people that keep seeking.
Mm-hmm. Also great for Quidditch.
I don't even know what that is.
All right, good. Again, it's good to end the podcast having to explain that. That's a Harry Potter joke.
Right.
I apologize. I'm sorry I just underscored the entire beautiful message that you had with a dumb fucking wizard sport joke.
Wouldn't be the next
fake
podcast
wizard
without it.
Hey, come on, Jonah. Say it's real. Keep seeking. I think that's a beautiful message. Always continue to grow. Always look for growth
Keep seeking that burrito.
Yep. And keep seeking mentalpod.com. Paul Gilmartin, it was lovely to have you on.
Thank you, guys. I really appreciate it.
And again, I urge people to listen to your podcast. Thanks, everyone. Keep seeking.
Now leaving nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast was brought to you by ThingX.com, brought to you by Adult Swim and former writers of The Onion. ThingX.com for most, if not all, of your interwebs needs.
Gen Z high school girls have gone through a lot. So what could and did send a shockwave through a group of 50 of them competing in one of the nation's biggest scholarship competitions? I'm your host, Shimo Liai, and I'm going to take you behind the scenes of the Distinguished Young Women Competition. I was Nevada's competitor 20 years ago, but this time, a Supreme Court decision catapults all 50 girls into the center of a nationwide debate about their rights. These girls, who have spent months fighting to make it to nationals, are faced with a tough decision. Do they speak up for their political beliefs, or do they stay focused on winning the money?
I think it's going to get ugly.
Follow the competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of the competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.